House Republicans were expected to release their long-awaited tax bill this afternoon after months of work on it. Members of the House Ways and Means Committee were negotiating final pieces of the text of the plan day and night in recent days. We're now hearing the plan is delayed until tomorrow. Republicans want to make roughly $5 trillion in tax cuts a reality over a decade. Howard Gluckman is a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he edits the fiscal policy blog TaxFox and the daily news summary, The Daily Deduction. Howard, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Kate.
Well, let's start with what kind of a big sticking point over the past few days, a deduction known as SALT, which allows individuals to deduct state and local taxes as well as their property taxes. And Republicans from high-tax states want to keep it while others want to get rid of it. Can you give us a little more detail on how this SALT write-off works?
Sure. So SALT is only one of many sticking points. They've got lots of things they have to work their way through. But the state and local tax deduction essentially says that you can deduct from your federal income tax the state and local taxes that you pay. And Republicans have proposed initially to repeal the state and local deduction so you could no longer take any tax deduction from your federal return for any state taxes that you pay. But they got a lot of pushback from Republican congressmen from high tax states. Turns out that there are almost 30 congressmen, Republican congressmen from states like New York and California, New Jersey, Illinois, that all have relatively high taxes and where the state and local tax deduction is very valuable to taxpayers. On average, the deduction is worth about $2,500 to people, so it's real money.
Well, who would benefit the most from the SALT deduction?
People who pay lots of state and local taxes. So if you have a high income and you live in a high tax state, you would benefit the most. So these Republicans basically said, we can't accept that. So the Republican leadership in the House has been looking for a way to scale this back. They need the deduction because, as you said, they want to cut taxes by $4 or $5 trillion. But they've also agreed that the total cost of the bill can't be more than $1.5 trillion. So that means they have to find $3 or $4 trillion in revenue raisers in tax increases on some people to offset the tax cuts on other people. State and local deduction is worth about $1 trillion. It's a big item. And if they can't do it, they're going to have to find the money somewhere else, or they're going to have to scale back the tax cuts.
You mentioned this is one of many sticking points, and now we've heard that this text of this tax plan is being held back another day. What is holding it back? What are lawmakers trying to get over here?
Well, as I said, the problem is that they all agree it's easy to agree to cut taxes. They've all agreed on that part. What they can't agree on is how to pay for it. And the state and local deduction is a big challenge. They don't know yet what the tax rates are going to be. When they originally proposed this, one of the big selling points, particularly for Republican constituency, was we're going to cut tax rates for everybody. Now it seems that they're saying, well, maybe we're not going to really cut tax rates, especially at the very top, which is a very un-Republican thing to do. So they're trying to figure out what the tax rates are going to be and what the tax brackets are going to be. The president's daughter, Ivanka, has proposed a child tax credit to enhance the existing child tax credit, but they can't agree on how big it would be, and they can't agree on who would benefit from it. One of the other proposals that's very important to the president is this idea of allowing people pay their business income on their individual tax returns, so-called pass-through companies like limited partnerships, allowing them a much lower tax rate than most people who pay taxes on their individual returns. Trying to figure out how to make that work, that's very hard. They're trying to design a new way to tax U.S.-based multinational corporations. No one's ever done it the way they're talking about doing it, so that's really hard. So there's a ton of things they have to sort out. As the president might have said, who knew that cutting taxes would be so difficult?
Well, yeah, and it seems like the House Ways and Means Committee is a far cry from reaching consensus here on this preliminary text. When it is released, what will we know from it? What mysteries will be solved?
Well, I think some of those questions I was just asking are the ones that they will try to answer. Now, they're going to do this, on a very expedited basis. Their original plan was to release the bill yesterday, or to release the bill today, and begin actually the process of writing the bill in the Ways and Means Committee on Monday and finishing it on Wednesday. That would be an extraordinarily rapid schedule for a bill that's supposed to be 1,000 pages or more long. So it's going to be a real challenge for them to get this all done. And you said negotiating in the Ways and Means Committee. Remember, they're just negotiating among Republicans. Democrats are completely cut out of this process. So this is really a struggle even to get Republicans to agree among themselves on what to do with this tax bill.
The chairman, Kevin Brady, he has been floating some compromises. One is keeping this property tax deduction, but eliminate the write-offs for state income taxes and local sales taxes. And Kevin Brady said the property tax deduction affects more middle-income taxpayers than the state income tax deduction. Do you agree or disagree with this assessment?
Well, the property tax deduction affects people who own houses.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger your house, the more valuable the deduction. And it's fair to say the bigger your house, the richer you are. So the property tax deduction benefits high-income people. The income tax deduction is interesting because, of course, there are 6 states in the country that don't have an income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So the residents of those states don't benefit at all from that. But, of course, residents of those states, say Florida, Texas, places like that, do own houses, and they would benefit from the property tax deduction. So it depends a lot on how much money you make. It depends on where you live. And it depends on how big your house is and how much of a mortgage you've got on it. So it's hard to just say that this is going to be good for middle-income people as opposed to somebody else. It really, a lot of these changes are really going to depend very much on your very specific situation.
Howard Gluckman is with us. He's a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he edits the fiscal policy blog TaxVox and the daily news summary, The Daily Deduction. We're discussing tax overhaul and basically what is the tax bill as it stands and not being released today. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Republicans' framework for tax reform? Should filers still be allowed to deduct their property taxes or not? What do you especially like or dislike about the GOP plan? What remains a mystery to you? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Howard, the National Association of Home Builders did an about-face. It withdrew its backing for the bill over the weekend. It had been an ardent supporter, and the group wanted to repeal deductions for property taxes and mortgage interest and replace them with this new tax credit. What can you tell us about how a tax credit would work?
So this is a little bit of a complicated story, but let me see if I can try to explain it. The Republican bill, as they've been talking about it since the president's been running for office, would have not touched the mortgage interest deduction. They explicitly said that the mortgage interest deduction would be exempt from any changes, except they're also proposing to do something else, which is to double the size of the standard deduction from about $12,000 to about $24,000 for a couple. If you double the size of the standard deduction, it makes the value of itemized deductions, like the mortgage interest deduction, less important. Because if you have a mortgage interest that's less than $24,000, and all your other itemized deductions are less than $24,000, you're not going to itemize. You're just going to take the standard deduction, which is simpler. So that would discourage some people, particularly middle-income people, from taking out a mortgage and buying a house. So the mortgage industry and the home building industry is very concerned about that change to the standard deduction. So what they've proposed instead is a tax credit. And a tax credit simply would be a dollar-for-dollar reduction in your income taxes, whether or not you itemized. Only about 30% of households itemize, and according to our estimates, some of the early proposals would have meant that only about 10% of people would have itemized. So the itemized deduction would have been irrelevant for lots of people. So therefore, the mortgage industry and the housing industry wants to change it to a tax credit, which would not be affected by this increase in the standard deduction.
Let's bring in the call now. Karen in Eau Claire joins us. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment on something that the person you have on there had commented about. The bigger your house is, the richer you are. We actually, I just want you to look at that from a little different perspective. 23 years ago, we purchased our home for $92,000, and today the value, the tax value of our house is about $180,000 because property values have gone up so much. And we have the same income that we had 23 years ago. So we absolutely are middle class people, and because we have a house that's worth $182,000, does not make us richer than somebody who has a house for $92,000. So just a little different way to look at that.
Yeah, Howard, go ahead.
So this is the problem with changing any of the tax benefits that are already in the code. Everybody wants to get a tax cut, but nobody wants to pay higher taxes on other expenses they have. So the argument that the caller makes, absolutely, you know, I completely understand her situation. But where is Congress going to get the money to pay for these tax rate cuts that they're promising everybody? It has to come from someplace. And if everybody says, but I have a special situation and it's going to hurt me, well, then the only way to get the money to pay for these tax rate cuts is to borrow it. And that's going to hurt our children and our grandchildren. So that in a nutshell, your caller has just explained why it's so hard for Republicans to find a way to not only cut taxes, which is the easy part, but also to raise taxes on other people to pay for those tax cuts.
Paul from Eau Claire emailed, and he wonders how people, including congressional Democrats, know that this plan cuts taxes for the rich if the bill hasn't been released.
Well, of course, we don't know exactly, but we do know the outlines. The president, during his campaign, provided actually three different tax plans. Last April, the president put out a summary of what he wanted to do. In September, he put out another summary of what he wanted to do. And the bill that they're talking about now roughly tracks all of those proposals. So it's true that we don't know exactly what this bill is going to do. In fact, the people writing it don't know exactly what it's going to do, but we know roughly what it's going to do. So when groups like the Tax Policy Center and other organizations do an analysis and talk about who would benefit and who wouldn't, you can at least get a rough sense of what the distributional effects are going to be. We won't know exactly until we see the language of the bill, but you can tell pretty roughly. Also, you know, it doesn't take a fancy computer model to know that when you have a proposal that's going to repeal the estate tax, that's going to cut rates on businesses, that the biggest beneficiaries of those are going to be high-income people. That's, you know, pretty self-evident. So we do know the rough outlines. We'll know more. We'll have more specific information, as the emailer suggests, when we see a specific bill.
Well, and it should be noted, too, that a lot of the plan's details are up in the air, so it is kind of an incomplete analysis. So we are still arriving at this conclusion that the richest will come out on top. What has the Tax Policy Center found in running the numbers so far?
Well, so we have run the numbers on previous proposals. Most recently, we ran numbers on the outline that the so-called Big Six, that the senior leadership in Congress, senior Republican leadership in Congress and the White House put out in September. And what we found there was that while on average everyone would get a tax cut, the tax cut would be much, much bigger for high-income people, 10 times as much for people in the top 1% as it would be for people in the middle-income people. So that proposal, which may not be exactly what they're going to come up with, but that rough outline would have cut taxes for everybody, but would have cut them a lot more for high-income people, and not just in dollar terms, but also as a percentage of their income.
Let's move on to discuss the health care deduction, and Tim in Hammond wants to discuss that. Tim, go ahead.
Yes, I am self-employed, and I heard somewhere in discussions of this plan that there was some talk of eliminating the deduction that a person like me would pay, that I have for the health care premiums that I pay, which currently are over $1,000 a month just for me. Do you know anything about that?
I have not heard that. Now there is a proposal out there. Again, it's sort of implied. One of the tax preferences out there is something called the medical expense deduction, which is different from the insurance premiums. Medical expense deduction says that if you spend more than a certain percentage of your income on medical expenses, including insurance premiums, you can deduct those. So that may be what you're thinking about. And the story about that is actually kind of interesting. The original medical expense deduction said that if your expenses exceeded 7.5% of your income, you could take the deduction. In 2010, in the Affordable Care Act, President Obama proposed to increase that to 10%. So in other words, it would be less generous. You couldn't take the deduction until your expenses exceeded 10% of your income. Republicans opposed that in 2010. And in fact, in the recent debate about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, they demanded that the threshold would go back down to 7.5%. Now they're at least implying that that they'd repeal the medical expense deduction entirely. So it's kind of an interesting flip-flop, and it kind of goes back to the previous caller, the woman who's concerned about her property tax.
Karen. Mm-hmm.
You know, once again, people can make a very legitimate point. You know, I don't want to lose my medical expense deduction. After all, I got sick. It wasn't my fault. Not only are my medical expenses high, but I've had to take time off of work, so my income is down. So this is really important to me. Once again, the question is, if you preserve the medical expense deduction, you preserve the property tax deduction, you preserve all these other deductions, how do you pay for the rate cuts?
Howard Gluckman is with us, a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he edits the fiscal policy blog TaxVox. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. What are you watching for in this tax plan? What piece of the tax reform plan would impact you the most? Join us. Will be the winners and losers in the tax overhaul? What about the pass-through rate? What will be the fate of the state and local tax deduction? We are expecting to have some answers this week as the House Ways and Means Committee prepares to release the text of its long-awaited tax bill. The draft bill should give us some ideas on tax rate brackets and a big reveal on the controversy over state and local tax deduction. Howard Gluckman stays with us. He's a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he edits the fiscal policy blog TaxVox and the daily news summary, The Daily Deduction. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Where do you see a common ground on tax reform? What about the give and take? Do you think you will win or lose in this GOP tax code overhaul? What questions do you have about tax reform in the Trump administration? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Gary, who has been waiting in Iron River. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, good morning. Say, it seems to me, in the interest of fairness across the country, all of the estate tax deductions need to go away. There's no logic for a person in a high-tax state of similar situation to pay less to support the federal income or the federal government than someone in a low-tax state. So the low-tax people end up supporting the low-tax state residents end up subsidizing the federal income tax of the people in high-tax states, and people need to get above their own personal interest and do what is logical. We hear this comment about fair, fair, fair. Fair doesn't just mean if you have money, you should pay more. It needs to be some consistent, justifiable policy across the country.
Howard, go ahead.
So this is an interesting argument. You often hear from supporters of repealing the state and local tax deduction. But in fact, if you look at the amount of money that states get from the federal government compared to the amount of money that state residents pay to the federal government, it turns out that high-tax states like New York and California actually contribute more to the federal government than they get back. And that low-tax states like Mississippi, Georgia, North Dakota, places like that, actually get more from the federal government than they pay in taxes. So if the caller is right, then we ought to be doing just the reverse. What happens here is that the supporters of repealing the state and local tax exemption are only looking at that one piece of the transaction between state residents, and that's the state and local deduction. They don't look at both sides of the transaction, which is also how much the federal government provides to states and how much federal residents contribute in all of their taxes, not just the state and local taxes. So, in fact, it's actually exactly the reverse of what the supporters of the tax bill argue.
Gary, thank you so much for bringing that up and for calling in. Howard, we in this conversation haven't dug into the corporate tax rate. The White House wants to lower the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% to stimulate economic growth. Other Republicans apparently want to phase in a cut over as many as 5 years. Regardless of which of those two roads we may ultimately take, or perhaps no road at all, what's the significance of cutting the corporate tax rate?
So here's the story. The statutory corporate tax rate, that 35% mm-hmm. rate that everybody talks about in the United States, is higher than it is in almost any other developed country. So there's an argument that people make that we ought to reduce that rate so it's more equal to what companies in other countries pay. But the story's a little more complicated than that, because not only do U.S. companies face a very high statutory rate, they also have lots and lots of tax preferences that allow them to lower the effective tax rate they pay, the amount that they really pay when they file their tax returns. So the effective rate for U.S. corporations right now is probably in the mid-20s, 25, 26%, something like that, which instead of being the highest in the developed world is about average for the developed world. You can make a good case that it would make a lot of sense for Congress to lower the statutory rate, lower that 35% rate to somewhere in the 20s, but also get rid of a lot of the tax preferences so that in the end, companies in a much simpler, less complicated way would be paying the same 25, 26% that they are now. That's the sort of the best argument for lowering the corporate rate. There's two problems with that. The first one is, just like we were talking about with individuals, companies don't want to give up those special tax preferences. So, you know, they want the lower rate, but they don't want to pay for it. The second issue is, if you don't pay for it, that means the federal government has to borrow more money. And if the federal government is borrowing more money, that's money that's not available to companies who might want to borrow the money to buy new equipment. If the companies end up paying more in interest to borrow money to buy equipment, and at the same time they're paying less in taxes, it all washes out in the end.
Mm.
And the net effect on the economy is actually quite small. And that's the kind of the nut of the argument that everybody's having about whether or not corporate tax rate cuts would boost the economy. And what I think most mainstream economists would say is, yes, they would, that lowering tax rates for corporations on balance is a good idea, and it probably would help the U.S. economy, but only if we figured out some way to pay for it. Because if we don't, it's going to drive up interest rates, and it's going to wash out all the beneficial effects of those lower tax rates.
And the White House put out a paper last month saying that reducing the corporate tax from 35 to 20% would boost worker incomes by $4,000 a year. Does that math add up?
No, it doesn't. First of all, the White House since then has kind of backtracked a little bit, and they said, well, it would be at $4,000 a year, but not right away. It might take a long time, and we don't really know how long it would take.
No, there's like a trickle down.
Well, it takes a long time because mm-hmm. the story you have to tell is that we would cut corporate taxes, that companies would take that additional after-tax income and buy more productive equipment, that more productive equipment would make workers more productive and workers would get raises as a result of that. So even if that's true, it would have to happen over a long period of time. And the other thing we've seen in the United States over the last 30 years is that the link between higher productivity and worker wages has broken. It used to be a firm belief of all economists that when productivity went up, when companies could make goods at less cost, mm-hmm. that the additional profits would go to workers. Well, that used to happen, but for the last 30 years, it hasn't happened. So there's no reason to believe that if you cut taxes for corporations and they make more profits, that they're going to give those profits to their workers. That just isn't happening anymore. We don't really know why. There's a lot of theories about it, but we don't really understand it very well. So you have to kind of believe every step along this story for it to come true. The other problem with the White House argument is the White House argued in the end that for every dollar of tax cut, workers would get $2.50 of benefits. They didn't say it that way, but that's what was implied in their argument. And you kind of look at that and just put the smell test on it, the common sense logic test on it, and you say that's probably not right. That probably doesn't make any sense. So I think the White House is dramatically overstating the benefits of corporate tax cuts to workers, but you're going to hear them say it a lot.
Let's bring in another call now. George has a question from Milwaukee. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, hi. I think one of the programs that really makes the most sense, especially for people on the lower end of the scale, is the Earned Income Tax Credit program. And I'm wondering if your guests could talk about what they're anticipating to happen with that.
So that's a good question. And this is one of the big holes in the proposal so far. So just to go back a little bit so your listeners understand, the Earned Income Tax Credit is in effect a welfare program. It's the way that the federal government can give money to low-income working families. So somebody who may not pay taxes at all may actually get a check back from the federal government to help support them, or families that pay some tax may get that tax reduced with this earned income credit, which is what they call refundable credit. It's very important to working families with kids. There have been a number of proposals, both from Republicans and Democrats, to expand the earned income credit. If you want to do what the president has been promising to do for a year now, which is target a tax bill to middle-income people, expanding their income tax credit is probably the best way to do it. But the tax bills that the president has proposed all through the campaign and since he's been president, the proposals that congressional Republicans have come up with, have essentially left that piece of the story out. They've all said, we are going to do something with the earned income credit, but we don't know what. And it remains to be seen whether the bill that we see tomorrow or next week or whenever it finally appears is actually going to have anything in it about the earned income credit. Sometimes what congressional Republicans have said is, we'll deal with that separately. We'll deal with it when we do welfare reform, not as part of a tax bill. They're under pressure from including Republicans like Marco Rubio, to deal with it in this bill. So it remains to be seen what actually happens.
Howard, George, thank you, by the way, so much for your call. And Howard, as we wrap up here in the last seconds we have with you, Republicans want to get tax reform passed quickly. They've got a very, very urgent timeline. The president wants to sign a bill on Christmas or around Christmas. Is this feasible? Is this possible?
So two things real quickly. First of all, it's not tax reform. The supporters of the bill like to call it tax reform. It isn't. It's just a tax cut. It's $1.5 trillion tax cut. It's not reforming the tax system at all. So can they do tax reform by the end of the year? No, because they're not going to do tax reform at all. The second question is, can they get anything done by the end of the year? I think that's pretty unlikely. The Senate is going to write a very different bill than the House. It's going to take a long time to sort through this. There are a lot of complicated details. I think this is probably going to take into sometime next year. But the truth is, it doesn't really matter. The end of the year deadline is an artificial deadline. It doesn't really affect people's lives one way or the other.
Well, Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Howard Gluckman is a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he edits the fiscal policy blog TaxVox and the daily news summary, The Daily Deduction. Earlier, we talked with Washington Post reporter Devlin Barrett about yesterday's terrorist attack in Manhattan. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Baltina. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.